Good morning. It's nice to be with you this morning. I'm Judy Fader. I'm Dean of the Georgetown Public Policy Institute and pleased to be one of the co-sponsors of this event. GPPI is fortunate to be the home of scholars and practitioners like Ambassador Schneider, who are dedicated to using the best in scholarship to promote the best in public policy. We are also proud to be training a new generation of public policy leaders who not only are committed to making the world a better and safer place, but happily will also have some skills to achieve that job. And as we can see this morning, if we did not know it already, God love them because we really need them. So it is also my personal pleasure to introduce our next speaker, the Honorable Richard Burr, Senator of North Carolina. Senator Burr has just recently moved from the House to the Senate and wasted no time in addressing the issues of concern to us today. As chair of the Senate Health Subcommittee on Bioterrorism and Public Health Preparedness, the senator is leading the Congress in deliberation and action to enhance our biosecurity. In recent hearings, he has brought together a varied and impressive set of experts in security and health to explore our exposure to microbial threats, whether natural, accidental, or deliberate, and to identify the measures necessary to address these threats. Senator, these hearings are providing lessons for scholars and students and the nation alike in terms of what to do about the issues before us, and we appreciate your willingness to share the benefit of these deliberations with us today. I give you Senator Burr.
Almost a good answer. Dean Fader, thank you so much for that kind introduction. What a treat it is to be asked to be here and to hopefully share some insight with you. And I can't thank the ambassador enough for her commitment to organize this session today. This is a challenge for me. It's not only a challenge to switch from the House to the Senate, but it's a challenge to be tasked with an issue that through the hearing process, I'm not sure we don't have more questions today than we do answers from where we started 5 months ago, but I will attempt to try to encapsulate for you this morning where we are, where we're attempting to go, but I will probably fall short of any expectations in the room that I've brought with you concrete solutions. Because clearly we're not there yet. I'd also like to thank the sponsors, Georgetown University, John Hopkins, Virginia Tech, University of Pittsburgh. I would remind all of you, we have some fairly good basketball teams in North Carolina. They also happen to be exceptional in public health at UNC and Duke, and I look forward to the opportunity to having them participate in these forums in the future.
Was that subtle?
The program today includes well-respected experts in the area of bioterrorism and infectious disease, representatives from both political parties. Likewise, infectious disease knows no borders and certainly has no political affiliations. This is definitely an issue where we can find common ground and work together to improve the bioterror preparedness of this country. As the chairman of the subcommittee, I'm fortunate to serve with Majority Leader Bill Frist, with my chairman, Mike Enzi, and with many colleagues on both sides of the aisle who are passionate about legislation as it relates to biodefense and biopreparedness. Like many in this room, 9/11 triggered for me a different way of thinking about bioterrorism. Mr. Stevens, the first victim of the anthrax attacks, was visiting North Carolina when he became ill. And I was serving in the House of Representatives, as the Dean said, at a time when the letters containing anthrax found their way to Capitol Hill, not just in the well-publicized Senate side, but in the Longworth building that was closed and affected my office for over 5 weeks. We work hard to improve our capabilities to detect and respond to biological threats, and I'm pleased to have worked on the bioterrorism legislation that passed out of the House. While all politics may be local, diseases, especially contagious ones, are global in nature. If there was any doubt about the global nature of natural, accidental, or deliberate outbreaks of disease, we have only to look at our experiences over the last 4 years to be reminded that infectious disease knows no boundaries. SARS, avian flu, Marburg, Ebola, H2N2 influenza, and anthrax are just some of the pathogens that have been that have made international headlines, reminding us that despite our achievements in the public health arena, diseases that can seriously impact society's health and security are just one plane ride away. Almost 40 years ago, former U.S. Surgeon General William Stewart declared we were within sight of winning the war on infectious disease. At that time, there were reasons for General Stewart's optimism. The efforts to eradicate smallpox were underway. A number of effective vaccines for terrible diseases such as polio and measles were developed. The control of mosquitoes had significantly changed and reduced malaria worldwide. And a variety of antibiotics were proven effective in reducing the morbidity and mortality of common infectious disease. But to borrow from Mark Twain, we now know the rumors of our victory were perhaps exaggerated. Mother Nature has proven herself a worthy adversary. Diseases like malaria and TB, once thought controlled and contained, have returned with a vengeance. HIV, SARS, and other diseases have appeared, and we now fear the emergence of a pandemic bird flu that appears capable of killing more than half of its human victims. Many antibiotics that were effective in the 1950s and 1960s are now less effective because of overuse, and this situation has resulted in the emergence of a resistance to bacteria. Furthermore, we face challenges on the national security front, as the threat of bioterrorism is no longer just a hypothetical consideration. We've committed enemies in Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda's affiliates, which have declared their intent to obtain and use weapons of mass destruction, including those that are biologic, chemical, and yes, nuclear. And finally, we're challenged by the current structure of our public health system. I'm concerned that our public health system is not fully prepared to face the challenges that we know are ahead. Last month, I chaired a congressional hearing to explore the current threats to the public health system. We know that in the near term, the deliberate use of anthrax or smallpox by terrorists is a real threat and as real as the pandemic avian influenza. The long-term challenges are just as great. The World Health Organization has said about one new disease is emerging each year. Therefore, we must prepare for the likelihood that these additional emerging diseases like SARS are a reality. We must also consider advances in biotechnology and synthetic biology, which provide the means to terrorists to develop superbugs, which are hybrid or novel pathogens that can get around our existing defenses or which have no known treatment at this time. We must address these threats today to ensure that we have the defenses needed to protect the Americans from deliberate, accidental, or natural biologic events in the future. In a rapidly changing world, we must ensure our capacity is broad and our response to an incident is quick. I believe we must have the ability to develop specific countermeasures like vaccines within weeks and months, rather than taking years to find a solution. As a sponsor of the Bioterrorism Act of 2002 and the BioShield Act of 2004 while serving in the House of Representatives, I believe we've made progress in addressing bioterrorism preparedness, but we still have a lot of work to do. BioShield ensures a federal government market for medical countermeasures, as well as speeds up the awarding of research biodefense grants intended, and I say intended, to encourage the development of new and improved countermeasures. Yet more should be done to ensure that we have medical countermeasures to meet the challenges we know we will face. I'll chair a hearing later this afternoon to assess the current challenges affecting the development of new medical countermeasures. Many small and medium-sized biotech companies face difficulty in securing the necessary capital to develop their potential countermeasures so the products can become eligible under the BioShield funding consideration. These companies provide innovative ideas and approaches for countermeasures, countermeasure development, but must cobble together private investment and government grants to perform the necessary development to become eligible under BioShield. These challenges have become known as the Valley of Death in developing potential responses to infectious disease, a point in the development process where we risk losing innovation and advancement. And this will not be the last time you hear us talk about the Valley of Death. Companies like AlphaVax, Hemocellular, EMD in my home state of North Carolina hold promising new therapies for biologic threats, radiation exposure, and cyanide poisoning. These companies can not only develop new countermeasures used to combat terrorism, but they can help revolutionize our approach to control infectious disease caused by Mother Nature. But in order for us to reap these benefits, these companies must meet the eligibility requirements for BioShield procurement. And getting these medical countermeasure innovations to the point that in the development process they qualify for BioShield is the most challenging thing today. We must also leverage the extraordinary investment and research sponsored by the National Institute of Health, Department of Defense, to ensure promising efforts to build new biodefense countermeasures aren't stalled or lost on their way through the BioShield development process. I'll work with my colleagues to put together a biodefense preparedness bill to help secure an effective developmental pipeline for new, safe, and effective countermeasures. We'll build excellent work done by my colleagues in Senator Frist, Senator Gregg, Senator Hatch, Senator Lieberman, Senator Brownback, and I look forward to working with them. I also look forward to working with Senator Enzi and Senator Kennedy to draft the legislation that I have been charged by my chairman to produce. I have made a public statement that we're not driven today by any outline that currently exists. We will take everything from every bill that exists today that we believe is crucial for a successful biodefense bill for this country in the future. While countermeasures are important tools in our ability to respond to deliberate, natural, and accidental outbreaks, I believe we need to include other issues in the biodefense preparedness legislation. We must revitalize our nation's public health infrastructure to ensure trained staff and new technologies are ready to confront events. This infrastructure must work seamlessly with the medical and emergency management communities, be capable of performing traditional public health functions, and have the ability to rapidly distribute medicines and administer vaccines in the event of an anthrax attack, smallpox attack, or flu pandemic. Currently, many states and localities are far from prepared for this new dynamic. Our efforts to improve the public health system must include clear standards of performance, and we must regularly test our system to assess the progress in achieving our goals. Real-time electronic surveillance for detection of emerging or re-emerging disease is a basic mission of public health. But we know that 3/4 of the states currently have no electronic disease surveillance system. We must use technology to make sure our public health officials are aware of local, regional, national, and international events affecting the nation's health. The detection of disease outbreaks is only the beginning of what needs to be done. We must also ensure that we recruit, train, and retain the public health responders that we need in the years ahead. We must also make more progress in securing our food supply and protecting agriculture from a terrorist attack as well as a natural phenomenon. I believe that we can and must draft a biodefense preparedness bill to address these preparedness issues, and doing this is the sole priority of the subcommittee this year. I know working with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, we can make improvements that will benefit all Americans. I look forward to exploring even further the obstacles to new medical countermeasures at our subcommittee hearing this afternoon. My goal, quite simply, is to improve the current development system so it can produce more countermeasures, produce better cutting-edge countermeasures, and produce countermeasures for the public faster. I am reminded that this is step one, that step two is the reauthorization that will need to happen on the bioterrorism bill that truly does address hospital preparedness, mass care, remediation, issues that I believe are too daunting to try to incorporate in a biodefense bill, but are absolutely as necessary to the answer of how we have a comprehensive response to a very real threat that exists to the United States of America, but more importantly, to the world today. With that, I once again thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I would be more than happy to entertain any questions you might have. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gerald Epstein at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I note that your subcommittee name, Bioterrorism and Public Health Preparedness, indicates two different aspects of one problem. This conference is talking about bioterrorism and emerging infectious disease, two aspects of one problem. And some of our earlier speakers, however, have talked about the importance of boundaries and distinctions, jurisdictions and delineations. And I'm wondering how we can really make progress on this unified problem when we have a system in which it is the federal government's responsibility to protect me from armed attack, but it is no government's responsibility to protect me from disease. If I'm above a certain income and below a certain age, that is not a governmental function. It's my employer if I'm lucky, or my bank account if I'm not. And we talked about if the federal government does actually get to address the H5N1 pandemic threat, then we will have stepped up to that public health issue. But that leaves H1N2, or the next flavor of flu, as not a federal responsibility. And I'm wondering, do we really have to, maybe this is a question I should address to the next speaker, your distinguished colleague from New York, but does this issue really force us to make some deep thinking about how we deliver health care in this country?
Well, I won't in any way suggest you shouldn't ask her the same question, but And you may, in fact, be asking the wrong person a jurisdictional issue. I come off the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House, and John Dingell taught me very early on, even though I was from the other party, when people ask what the jurisdiction is, always have a globe of the world in your office. So we had no limitations, and my expectations being in the Senate is you're only challenged by how you craft a bill as to where your limitations exist or don't exist on jurisdiction. I think you're right. I think that the U.S. government does have a responsibility to attack. I think you're also right in the fact that we need to rethink healthcare at all levels to have a healthy debate. Healthcare is the number one crisis in this country. And we're asked to try to address what we do to prepare for the threats of nuclear threat today. We do that into a system that needs to be structurally changed, and I openly admit that. But I think it's also going to be government's responsibility to drive the debate on where healthcare goes and what it looks like in the future. It will not happen naturally. If it would have, it would have already changed by now. So I see a U.S. government responsibility there, too. That is not to suggest that I'm a proponent for the U.S. government taking over the healthcare system. Yes, sir.
Yes, Jim Bolden, Virginia Tech. There's been a lot of focus, rightfully so, I think, on infectious diseases and health issues. But let me pose a couple of other concerns that I think your committee ought to address, and that's bioterrorism with respect to agriculture and livestock. I think plants and animals also are susceptible to pathogens, and the enormous economic impact of some of those pathogens on destroying certain agricultural commodities or livestock are equally important. So I would just urge that your committee address those very, very carefully.
I would encourage you not to take the one paragraph that I devoted to agriculture and food safety and walk away with the belief that proportionately that's the amount of our attention it gets. It becomes a bigger piece of what we're looking at every single day that we move forward in the subcommittee. Again, we fight the jurisdictional issue that was just raised about where the jurisdiction of our committee starts and where it stops, and clearly agriculture is not an area. But I think you would be shocked if you knew the support we had from the committees that have the true jurisdiction that are saying, go ahead and do our piece. You're in a perfect place to do it. So what turned out to be something that reflects bills that have been introduced that deal with medical countermeasures, I can tell you that the scope of what we envision finally ending up with does include food safety. It includes the agricultural piece. It includes, to a large degree, redefining the role of public health in America. And I would tell you that that's probably a monumental task in itself. But I'm not sure that we can address the other successfully without doing that piece as well. Yes, sir.
Chuck Ludlam with Senator Lieberman. You've mentioned jurisdiction twice, so you're one of perhaps eight committees that have jurisdiction over the full range of subject matters. We mentioned Agriculture, Finance Committee for Tax, Patent the Judiciary Committee for Patents, perhaps Banking for Vaccine Accounting Issues, Homeland Security for Command and Control Issues, perhaps Foreign Relations dealing with distribution of countermeasures. Do you think you have a commitment from the leadership, Senator Frist, to bring together all the committees, because that's really the way you get a comprehensive bill?
Well, Chuck, you raise a great question, and you've got more experience at maneuvering through the jurisdictional battles of the United States Senate than I do. I'm going to be more like a bull in the China store. I think if in fact we're thorough enough in what we present, then the challenge will be for those other committees to display the same level of education to tackle it. In the absence of that, I think the leadership will give us the jurisdiction. We can't accomplish something of this magnitude and complexity without bipartisan support, whether that's Senator Lieberman, Senator Kennedy, it means Chairman Enzi. There's nobody that gets rolled in this process. I think at the end of the day, I can assure you this will probably be one of the most transparent processes you have seen on Capitol Hill. Our attempt is not to create winners and losers. It is to create winners across the board. And the winners are the American people have a higher level of security because of the refinement of a biodefense bill. Yes, ma'am.
In the bill that Deanne Divis with the Washington Examiner, in the bill that you're describing, can you elaborate on liability provisions, how they'll be contained, how they'll be shaped, and where you stand on the progress on that?
No, ma'am.
Well, it liability is addressed in the bill.
Let me address it in a broad sense with no specifics, because I can honestly tell you that I don't know what that provision should be today. That clearly, Senator Hatch and Senator Lieberman believe that there should be extensions on patents that might encourage a more robust participation. They could very well be right. Some believe that liability precludes companies from participating because of the exposure that they fear may be there, and clearly the history of vaccines has proven is there. They may be right as well. I would tell you that there is a new issue that I'm focused on very heavily right now, and that's a lack of understanding of the procurement process at the end of the road. My concern today is that may play a greater role in the lack of robust participation than the other two. It's not to say that the other two don't have to be addressed. I think what we're going to find is a blend of all that it takes to get the level of participation that we think we need from all areas of the research and development bench that it's going to take for us to successfully address the threats that are out there. So yes, I believe liability is going to play a part. Patent extension may play a part. It may be constructed differently and designed differently than what is on the table today. But the only way that I'll ever get a piece of legislation like that through is if I can convince everybody that the balance that we've chosen is, in fact, the correct one. And so that's the task that's before us.
Regulations or some other aspect of procurement?
I'm talking about the ability for a company to have some certainty of understanding of what at the end of the process, what the government's commitment to purchase a product is and how it works. And it, to some degree, it gets back to what Chuck raised about the banking jurisdiction that exists there. Who would have ever thought in the children's vaccine program that Sarbanes-Oxley was drastically changed based upon an accounting interpretation of what happens when a company no longer ships out product that's sold, that they can't claim it as revenue even though the federal government has paid them. And not only can they not claim it as revenue, they have to list it as a liability because it's still in their inventory even though they don't own it. Sarbanes-Oxley has created an animal that we don't understand fully how, one, it affects children's vaccine program, but two, we should be very cautious as we move forward about how Sarbanes-Oxley and the accounting decisions are going to affect anything that we do in the biodefense bill as it relates to what we expect companies to do and how they inventory product, but more importantly, how they accurately account for the activities that happen in their businesses. Once again, I want to thank you for the gracious opportunity to be here and to encourage you to stay engaged in this process in every way that you can. It's important to all of us. Thank you very much.
Senator Clinton, thank you for your leadership, and it is a pleasure to have you with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judy. Thank you for your long service on behalf of improving health. And it is a little bit disconcerting to be in this beautiful room in one of the most beautiful buildings in our country talking about such a sober topic as we're addressing today. I feel sad, I guess, is the best description, that we're still talking about this and that we haven't done more in the last 3.5 years to deal with the clear challenge posed by the title of this symposium, Preparing for the Inevitable, Bioterrorism and Emerging Infectious Diseases. But it is important that we keep trying, and I thank all of you for being here to discuss the intersection of security and public health. As Judy said, I serve on both the Senate Armed Services Committee and the Committee with Jurisdiction over Health, and I've had the opportunity to view and work on this issue from a number of perspectives. I appreciate my colleague, Senator Burr, who is now chairing the important subcommittee on our health committee dealing with bioterrorism and public health preparedness. I know that there is far too little communication among the various sectors in our government and our society who need to be responsible for our preparation, for the strategies and tactics that we employ in both preventing and responding to any attack. If we look at where we are now, we know we need a multi-level response, obviously among government agencies, among all levels of government, between the public, private sectors, as well as the not-for-profit sector, and throughout the world. Because the threats, as you know so well, are all too real. We know now that in the late 1990s, Al-Qaeda trained its members to produce biological agents, and had plans to develop a delivery device with which to weaponize these agents. So we cannot be speaking about a more timely topic. But let's start with the basic need to improve coordination within the federal government and between the federal, state, and local governments. We've already experienced one bioterror incident in the United States when a still unidentified source sent anthrax through the mail. Now, those attacks were directed at colleagues of mine in the Senate and at several news organizations, but their consequences were felt throughout the country. The 2001 anthrax attacks caused several deaths, including one of a hospital employee from the Bronx, and caused severe economic harm. They also struck fear in the hearts of millions of Americans. In New York, we've tried to marshal our public health system to respond to the threats we face with some success. Both the RAND Corporation and the Trust for America's Health have cited New York City's reporting mechanisms, including syndromic surveillance and electronic laboratory result reporting, as models that could be used around the country. But despite the spotty progress that we can point to in New York and elsewhere, we still do not have the overall capability to respond to an attack. As recent various simulation exercises and bioterror scares in both the Senate and the Pentagon have shown us. In January of this year, for example, the Atlantic Storm exercise gathered together former and current high-level government officials from the United States and Europe to role-play a scenario in which a weaponized version of smallpox was released on a global scale. Participants had the unenviable task of deciding how to deploy our scarce biodefense resources internationally. In short, how to vaccinate 3 billion people against a highly contagious, often lethal disease. The results were not encouraging. And as a result of that exercise, we have once again been reminded of how inadequate our preparation and coordination is within our country and with allies around the world. Now, we've passed legislation, and, you know, that is a start. We passed the Bioterrorism Act of 2002, Project BioShield in 2004, both of which will help us develop treatments and vaccines for threatening agents such as smallpox. But we clearly have to go further than just passing legislation. And we can by not only looking at this legislation, but having a 24/7 commitment with somebody in charge. One of the points I want to leave with you is nobody is. Can I get some water? I guess there's some right there. I can assure you it's allergies, nothing more serious. Or at least I think I can. We need to ensure that if a bioterror attack is launched, our health delivery system is prepared to handle the outbreak as a matter of health care and national security. It's important to improve the health infrastructure and to develop countermeasures and a delivery system to get treatment to the public as quickly as possible. We are not making the investments in public health preparedness that are required for the scale of the threat that we face. We are also not addressing the security needs to try to prevent such attacks in the first place. Former CIA Director John Deutsch testified before Congress last month that despite many warnings and some progress by the many government agencies involved, our territory, citizens, agriculture, and livestock remain unacceptably vulnerable to a catastrophic biological agent attack. Now, prevention is largely the responsibility of the intelligence and military communities and the law enforcement communities charged with protecting our national and homeland security. And I know that in the past, the intelligence community has not always been prepared to deal with such threats. As a March 2005 report of the Commission on Intelligence Capabilities noted, bioterror threats were often considered secondary to nuclear threats, because terrorists were thought to lack the capability to produce or adequately deploy biological threats. And many thought that we could address any bioterror threat with a threatened nuclear response against a rogue government. However, as we all know too well, Our greatest threats no longer come from rogue states, but from individuals, cells, and groups with minimal technical knowledge and a small investment of resources that can launch a bioterrorist attack on us. Even if the United States is not the target of such an attack, our nation is still threatened by the prospect of attacks being unleashed on other nations. Globalization means that none of us is isolated. A person can get from one side of the globe to another in a matter of hours. That creates not only enormous opportunities to spread disease, but even to create carriers who are intentionally spreading diseases. The scale of the risk is enormous. Over 4,000 cases of SARS, half the cases in the epidemic, were traced to one individual's single night stay in a Hong Kong hotel. Detecting bioterror threats poses a particular challenge to the intelligence community. In traditional weapons analysis, the presence of substances like highly enriched uranium serves as evidence of weapons programs. But it is decidedly more difficult to discern whether a biolaboratory is being used for research purposes or to create weaponized diseases. Rapid advances in the medical field are also creating challenges for the intelligence community, which is desperately trying to keep up with scientific advancement. Breakthroughs in areas like genetics not only have the possibility to revolutionize the way we treat diseases, but also the way terrorists weaponize biological agents. An official with the CIA's Counterproliferation Division said in December 2004, "We don't know more about the biological weapons threat than we did 5 years ago, and 5 years from now, we will know even less." It's important to bear in mind that man-made bioterror threats are just half of our security challenge. Naturally occurring epidemics also have the potential to kill millions of people and undermine our economy. Military and intelligence analysts are well versed in the security implications of a disease like HIV/AIDS, which has devastated entire countries, destabilized civil societies, and created a pool of orphans who can be recruited as child soldiers or into terrorist movements. We need to model the ways that naturally occurring pandemics like avian influenza can also wreak havoc upon our public health, political, and security systems within a relatively short period of time. And when we develop such analyses and when we uncover information about potential terrorist threats, we need to do a better job of sharing this vital security information with both the public, health community, and with state and local authorities. Biodefense agencies are housed at over a dozen agencies, from the CIA to the Environmental Protection Agency. In the absence of effective coordination, our scarce anti-bioterror resources are not being utilized effectively. We especially need to develop a reliable, effective mechanism for communicating threats from the federal to the local level, to assist, for example, what county health departments may be facing if there is a threat that they're going to encounter. I know that there have been some concerns about state bioterror funding and the way that such monies are being used in a public health infrastructure that is itself woefully underfunded. But if state and local entities had a better sense of the threats they faced, and if there was more federal direction about how that money should be spent, they could be better prepared for identification, treatment, and containment on the front lines. When our first responders do not have the information they need to respond effectively, a small targeted attack could easily explode into an unmanageable epidemic. Health information technology offers us a powerful tool in helping to make advances in this area. We need to develop an interoperable health IT infrastructure that will allow public health and national security workers to share information and surveillance data so we can better identify outbreaks when they happen, alert health providers in time to save lives, and have providers standing by with the knowledge and training they need to deal with such attacks. A bill that I will introduce soon with Senator Frist will address this need by authorizing the development of an interoperable health IT infrastructure that includes, as one of its fundamental purposes, the ability to detect and respond to public health threats, including bioterror events and infectious disease outbreaks. A May 2003 Government Accountability Office report noted that across the six key agencies engaged in bioterror preparedness, there were a total of 70 information technology systems in use or planned for use without any formal coordination. to ensure that the information collected by one system can be communicated efficiently to another system. A December 2004 report from the Trust for America's Health reports that two-thirds of our states do not electronically track outbreak information using national standards, and many of them rely on phone or fax lines to do the reporting. Unfortunately, we know that phone and fax lines can fail. In emergencies, when everyone will be calling a hospital or health department trying to get more information, we cannot rely on those methods to get what is needed to respond. Phone and fax reporting mechanisms also delay response times and require additional use of scarce public health resources for administrative tasks like data entry. We need to have a more secure form of technology, an interoperable system that can transmit real-time data to all relevant agencies so that they have the tools necessary to perform a rapid, accurate, and thorough analysis of the threat. We also need to ensure that information flows both ways so that it's not just state and local health departments reporting to the federal government, but the federal government releasing information about outbreaks, the best way to treat them, the latest case totals and containment methods. With effective two-way communication, which sounds so obvious that it's almost embarrassing to talk about it, our state and local health departments will be able to take the best possible prevention and treatment measures. By getting information to the people who can spread the message in the community, the police, the elected officials, the trusted doctors, the hospital administrators, we can forestall some of the panic and anxiety that will occur. Earlier this year, when the Pentagon suffered a potential anthrax attack, state and local health departments were not immediately notified, and local resources were not used to confirm the potential exposure. Had it been an actual anthrax attack, these delays could have seriously compromised our ability to respond. In addition to improving the public health reporting infrastructure, we need to explore the use of new technologies to improve our surveillance capabilities in the vein of the World Health Organization's use of mapping software and NASA satellites in their surveillance and detection efforts. And that, too, will require improved coordination among federal agencies and between the federal government, state, and local governments. We must develop a unified structure and plan for dealing with the bioterror threat rather than continuing this fragmented approach. Now, President Eisenhower built the interstate highway system during the Cold War as a mechanism to be prepared in the event of an attack from the Soviet Union. It was thought that people would be able to move quickly from one place to the other, that supplies and troops would be able to use the interstate highway system. Well, we need to build up our interstate and international public health system to protect us from bioterror threats. And what I'm saying about bioterror threats can be equally applied to radiological and chemical threats as well. And just as the benefits of the interstate highway system extended beyond national security interests, so will an enhanced, well-coordinated, and interoperable bioterror response system reap rewards for the overall healthcare system. Now, like everyone in this room, I hope and pray we never experience another bioterror attack. And I, along with my colleagues, will be working to do what we can at the legislative level to try to make that a reality. But I worry that we don't have the appropriate focus or discipline to address this threat. If it's an inevitable threat, in the eyes of many experts, as I know many of you believe, then the sad reality is we are not prepared. A few years ago, after September 11th, my friend Dr. Irwin Redlener and I went on a kind of tour of New York talking about bioterrorism and talking about the need for local communities to be thinking about what they needed to do. And, you know, we went to Brooklyn, and we went to Syracuse, we went to a few other places, and there was a great eagerness to know what people were supposed to do, doctors and nurses and hospital administrators and National Guard and law enforcement. People came to the forums that Irwin and I held. We could go back and do those forums again today, and there would be some progress, but inadequate to the task that we face. I've worried a lot about this because I don't really understand it. I don't understand why we don't have the equivalent of a Manhattan Project for defensive purposes, and that we're not utilizing the, you know, the best and the brightest to help us be as prepared as possible. And I have to add to my concern the fact that the current budget we're considering cuts money for research and science. You know, at the very moment when we probably need to incentivize the scientific enterprise as greatly as we did after Sputnik, we are cutting funding. And we're making some very short-sighted decisions. I'll just end with one because it's particularly troubling to me. In addition to cutting the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, so many of the scientific enterprises, many of you know that for many years now, DARPA, the Defense and Research Project Agency within DOD, has conducted both applied research and has carried out university partnerships. And a lot of basic pure science has been done with no end in sight, no definite goal. And out of that wonderful public-private intellectual partnership came the internet, came the microprocessor, have come so many of the ideas, the inventions, the creativity, the intellectual capital that has changed the world we live in. The administration has decided to shift most of the funding away from those university partnerships into basically applied research. Now, we have some serious problems. You know, what are we going to do about improvised explosive devices that are killing our young men and women in Iraq and Iraqis? We should definitely be on the fastest possible track to figure out how to jam the signals, how to detect and defend against, but not at the expense of doing what needs to be done in this area of really funding thinking, funding scientific experimentation, funding the most brilliant minds in our country to think about what we should be doing. And much of what we are not doing is because of the deficit. And so let me just end on a political note, because we can't pretend that these are not decisions that are being made or not being made. We have a very large deficit, and that large deficit is squeezing money that should be going to homeland security, should be going to scientific research, should be going to the preparation and the planning. We should be looking at our hospital capacity and figuring out what we need for surge capacity. We should be making sure every public health department in America had up-to-date, you know, electronic communication systems. We should be putting in place a better electronic surveillance system that can report and pick up information. We know what needs to be done, but it requires resources, and resources are being squeezed because of the large deficit we're in. And I think it's a very sad case of misplaced priorities. And we are going to need a much more vigorous response from the public, from those in the public and private health sectors, from the academic community, from people who have studied these issues, understand what it is we're up against. Irwin, in his position at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia, commissioned a survey, and he and I unveiled the results of the survey about 2 years ago now. And it was a nationwide survey asking people, this is, you know, 2 years after September 11th, asking people if they thought we were better prepared, if they would believe what they were told by the government about attacks or threats. And this was after, you know, we'd had red lights and green lights and orange lights and yellow lights and one person saying one thing and somebody else saying something else. And the result of the survey was that people did not think we were well prepared, and they didn't know who to believe. They didn't know if they would follow directions if they were given directions, because they weren't sure what the basis of it was. So in addition to everything else we need to do to get the systems up and going, we still have a considerable public education campaign. We need to enlist the eyes and the ears and the noses and the feelings and the experiences of the American public so that they too are part of our first line of defense. So I'm hoping that we will see some progress, but I think we've got to make sure that we have a lot of voices out there encouraging that progress and trying to hold elected leaders at all levels of government accountable for what we have not yet done, because none of us want to believe that this threat is inevitable. We want to believe that we can prevent it, deter it, defend against it, because we're well prepared. Thank you all very much. I think I've got time maybe for one question, Cynthia, maybe one question, because I've got to run to another engagement.
My name's Chris Melanson with Applied Biosystems, and I actually have many of the bright minds that you refer to at my company who enabled the Human Genome Project, who are now ready to respond to this national need. I posed a question earlier to Senator Lieberman about cross-agency standards, so the agencies that set the requirements for my research and development teams. And I wondered how I can get those agencies to work together in establishing standards. His response was, someone needs to be in charge, and you have highlighted that need again today. My question to you is, who should be in charge? Who should be driving those cross-agency standards so that I can start to focus on those areas?
Well, I think that you could put the entity, the person in charge in a couple of different places. Probably the two most obvious choices are the Department of Homeland Security or Health and Human Services. And, you know, it's not so much where it is or who it is, that it be somebody. And, you know, for some people on the Hill, standards are not, an attractive idea, you know, that they don't want the government setting standards. I don't see how you do this unless there's standards. And that's what I don't get. And it's the same with health information technology. I mean, we're putting forth legislation that will drive a process that at least has a framework for standards so that, you know, why should everybody go off and spend hundreds of millions of dollars building systems that can't talk to each other? And we're doing it inside the government and outside the government. So it's a Tower of Babel. It makes no sense at all. So, you know, I think that the White House has to make this decision, and I just don't understand why this is such a difficult decision to make. Somebody must be in charge. There has to be some entity, some agency, ultimately some person that we all look to, and that is responsible working across the government. And a lot of our rules in the government need to be changed. I mean, we've had a horrible time computerizing the FBI, for example. And some of it is because we have, frankly, rules that are no longer applicable. They're not current. They're of the past. We need to look at new procurement rules, new rules for using consultants, new rules for, you know, trying to drive a quality process more like the private sector, but with checks and balances so that we don't go off the ledge and, you know, have something that is unaffordable and doesn't work. So, I mean, it's that balancing act. But until we have, I mean, who the person in the United States government is that is responsible for defending and preventing bioterrorism is named, we're going to continue to have a bunch of different people working on this without any real coordination. And I think that's a lot of lost time and opportunity. So I hope it'll happen. Maybe all of you could, you know, write a letter, do a petition, do something, just trying to say, you know, we're in this field, we care about this, we need to know, who do we look to, who's responsible, who's in charge. If I'm going to make an investment in an area of research, if I'm going to hire somebody, if I'm going to, you know, maybe invest in, you know, some new level of computational ability, am I doing the right thing? I need to know, where's the framework? So maybe that'll get somebody's attention. Thank you all very much.
Just take a couple of minutes to conclude first by thanking all of the speakers. They're not all here, but I hope some of you will percolate it back to them. I think I don't know about you, but I feel very lucky to have heard all these extraordinary talks this morning, and I want especially to thank the panelists. Thank you for being understanding about the time and for managing to fit an incredible amount of information into a short period of time. I also want to thank those behind the scenes who helped to make this possible. Imani Nagesh and Josh Wiersing of the House Homeland Security Committee, Andrea Palm with Senator Clinton, Bob Cadlec with Senator Burr. I want to particularly mention the Center for Biosecurity at the University of Pittsburgh. Many people there who helped me, and Tara O'Toole was extremely helpful thinking this out all along the way. But I want to also mention Tom Inglesby, Molly DeSopo, Jackie Fox, BJ Otte. I appreciate the help so much. From Virginia Tech, I want to thank Jim Boland, Denise Orden, and Barbara McCauley. Also Judy Fader, Rosemary Derita at the Public Policy Institute at Georgetown, Emily Maganam, Lindsay Holloman, and my assistant Brian Schubert, who many of you have been in touch with. Also Christy Beckwith and Brian Olivi at the Library of Congress. I think we've had a few common themes that we can actually take away from today. We've heard over and over again about the importance of health IT and systems that meet each other, that work together. That's a message we can take out of here. Another message that's come over and over again is the importance of working out this public-private partnership, finding the right kind of incentives, not just saying we've done it, but finding the right kind of incentives, and that's going to be, for some people, maybe not coming so naturally, but finding the right kind of incentives to really engage the best minds in the private sector in this endeavor. We've also heard about the disconnect between the systems both within agencies and also federal, state, and local, and the need for really practical assignments of responsibilities in a way that will work. I want to let all of you know we will be in touch with you. We are going to post the proceedings, both the transcripts and a live stream, on both the GPPI website and my Life Science and Society Initiative website. It will also be posted on Science Network. If you have already responded to the biosecurity conference at georgetown.edu, then we know your information. If you have not, would you please either or maybe both, just so you don't slip through the cracks, leave a card in the basket outside, and then even after the meeting, just send an email to biosecurityconference, one word, at georgetown.edu, and then we'll have you in our grasp, and we'll send you information when this is posted, and we will also send, once we've collected all of the information about everyone who is here, we'll send information about who was here. If you object to that, having your email given out, let us know. Otherwise, we will do that. Now, I'd like to conclude. I always like to do this. I also do cultural diplomacy, and the great thing about these two things, science and cultural diplomacy, is you can always begin or end with Thomas Jefferson. So I try to begin or end with him no matter what I'm doing. And once again, he hasn't failed me. He wrote something that goes, I think, right to the heart of what we've been talking about today, the intersection of science and politics. He wrote in 1809 in a letter to Pierre Samuel Dupont de Nemours, quote, "Nature intended me for the tranquil pursuits of science by rendering them my supreme delight. But the enormities of the times in which I live have forced me to take part in resisting them and to commit myself on the boisterous ocean of political passions." Well, I think Washington's been pretty inundated by the boisterous ocean of political passions lately. But let's hope that with regard to the issues that we've been talking about today, bioterrorism and infectious disease, those oceans don't flood the field so that we don't get anything done, and that we can continue to work together, Republican and Democrat, scientist and policymaker, and businessman and academic, not only to fortify ourselves against a potential attack, but also to improve the quality and efficacy of healthcare in the process. Thank you very much.